whenever you like.
Okay, going. Rope. About the events of that evening, the events that set human malice loose in the world again, Toby later made two stories. The first story was the one she told out loud to the children of Crake. It had a happy outcome, or as happy as she could manage. The second, for herself alone, was not so cheerful. It was partly about her own idiocy, her failure to pay attention, but it was also about speed. Everything had happened so quickly. She'd been tired, of course. She must have been suffering from an adrenaline plunge. After all, she'd been going strong for 2 days, with a lot of stress and not much to eat. The day before, she and Wren had left the safety of the Mad Adam Cobhouse enclave that sheltered the few survivors from the global pandemic that had wiped out humanity. They'd been tracking Wren's best friend, Amanda, and they'd found her just in time, because the two painballers who'd been using her had almost used her up. Toby was familiar with the ways of such men. She'd been almost killed by one of them before she'd become a God's gardener. Anyone who'd survived painball more than once had been reduced to the reptilian brain. Sex until you were worn to a fingernail was their mode. After that, you were dinner. They liked the kidneys. Toby and Wren had crouched in the shrubbery while the painballers argued over the raconte they were eating and whether to attack the Krakers and what to do next with Amanda. Wren had been scared silly. Toby hoped she wouldn't faint, but she couldn't worry about that because she was nerving herself to fire. Which to shoot first, the bearded one or the short hair? Would the other have time to grab their spray gun? Amanda wouldn't be able to help or even run. They had a rope around her neck with the other end tied to the leg of the bearded one. A wrong move by Toby and Amanda would be dead. Then a strange man had shambled out of the bushes, sunburned and scabby and naked, and clutching a spray gun, and had almost shot everyone in sight, Amanda included. But Wren had screamed and run into the clearing, and that had been enough of a distraction. Toby had stepped out, rifle aimed. Amanda had torn free, and the painballers had been subdued with the aid of some groin kicks and a rock, and tied up with their own rope, and with strips torn from the pink and new you spa top-to-toe sun cover-up that Toby had been wearing. Wren had then busied herself with Amanda, who was possibly in shock, and also with the scabby naked man, whom she called Jimmy. She'd wrapped him up in the rest of the top-to-toe, talking to him softly. It seemed he was a long-ago boyfriend of hers. Now that things were tidier, Toby had felt she could relax. She'd steadied herself with a gardener breathing exercise, timing it to the soothing rhythm of the nearby waves, wish-wash, wish-wash, until her heart had slowed to normal. Then she'd cooked a soup. And then the moon had risen.
Very nice, thank you. Mad Adam is the final book in a trilogy that began with Oryx and Crake and Year of the Flood a few years later. I've seen that you've described this one as jauntier than the previous book, but I have to say, from listening to even those first few pages, doesn't sound particularly jaunty, does it?
Well, that was a reprise of the previous less jaunty events. It gets jauntier after that. That's only page 9.
But it does kind of sum up where things are at the beginning of the book. It helps us to understand and it moves us forward. It gets jauntier from there. Can you give us a kind of a storyline?
Well, it gets a bit jauntier. But I think that, you know, there are three time levels in the trilogy. One is before the waterless flood. The next is during the waterless flood, which is a pandemic virus that acts very rapidly and to which humanity has no immunity. And then the third time period, which we're in now, is after that has happened. And I think after the worst is over, you always get a bit jauntier, don't you think?
You begin hoping for the future, I guess.
Yes, you can. You're in a position in from which you can plan forward at least a couple of weeks ahead, maybe.
One of the plans forward started much earlier, as a matter of fact, and we see them, we meet them right away at the beginning of this, the Krakers. We've met them before in the earlier volumes, but if you're picking up here, it's important to know who they are. They are genetically engineered humanoids?
They're genetically engineered humans, I maintain, who have had some of the defects removed from them that have bedeviled us over the millennia. And have got us into a lot of scrapes. For instance, they have built-in sunblock, which would be a good thing, and they have built-in insect repellent, which I'm all for, and they have extra thick soles on their feet, and therefore they don't need the clothing industry, so they will never have any cotton plantations, nor will they be killing animals and wearing their skins. So they also have built-in purring, which they use to self-heal. And I did get some pushback on that from the first book when I put it in. But I note that science has now been working on that. And yes, cats purring apparently does have something to do with self-healing. And you will note that when your cat will take quite an interest in you if you're ill, and it will get up and purr on the afflicted part. And we're now told that if you have a migraine headache, you should put a cat on your head. There are no instructions as to how to keep it there. So, you know, if somebody can invent that, the wear-to-work model, put a cat on your head.
But I think most cat owners have had the experience of a cat wrapped around their head.
Absolutely. And you know that if somebody comes into the house and is afraid of cats, your cat will immediately go to that person because they want to help out. So they have self-healing purring, and better than everything, they will never suffer from romantic disappointment because they mate seasonally, unlike us. And to make things even clearer, so there will never be any confusion, parts of them turn blue at that time. they do it in groups so that there isn't a paternity issue. And they will never have to have agriculture either because they can eat leaves and grass.
They sound almost perfect, except that, of course, once you get to know them, those perfections aside, they are incredibly naive.
Well, they're quite naive because they don't know about any of the things that we have been doing, and nor do they know about any of our inventions and technologies. And they certainly don't know much about parts of our human nature. They find, for instance, our meat eating to be truly, really horrifying to them.
They talk about, are you eating the smelly bones?
Yes, because it's built in into their nature that they will find such things repugnant.
We should meet some of the other...
Also, yeah, sorry.
Go ahead.
They're non-aggressive, which is one reason that their maker felt he had to eliminate us, because faced with us, they would have no defense.
We should meet some of the other survivors. You said in your introduction that it killed all of mankind, this waterless flood, but that's not quite true. There are some left. Toby and Zeb, for instance, we were introduced to fairly early on. Can you tell me about them?
Yes. The people who have not been killed by the fast-acting pandemic have avoided it by being secluded from it. And Toby, who was a God's Gardener, and the God's Gardeners were a green religious cult during the first period, a period dominated by corporate control and other areas of society, which were very slum-like and anarchic. So the God's Gardeners lived in slums but raised vegetables and bees on rooftops while preparing for the waterless flood that they felt sure was to come. And Toby had been rescued by them and was therefore living with them and became one of them, in name anyway. Zeb appeared amongst them He didn't really fit in. He seemed to have an interesting relationship with their leader, Adam One, but he seemed to be more of a street smart, somewhat more aggressive type of personality. And amongst the gardeners, he taught several subjects to the children, one being urban bloodshed limitation, which began with the caveat that the first bloodshed you should limit should be your own. So Toby had quite a fancy for Zeb, but that never came to anything in the year of the flood. In Mad Adam, it does. So Toby and Zeb become a couple.
Zeb's father, I think, was the reverend of the Church of Petroleum. Is that right?
The Church of Petroleum.
Excuse me.
You have to get the pronunciation right.
The Church of Petroleum.
Yes, well, it is founded on Scripture, because what does Peter mean but a rock? And it is the same root as petroleum. And upon this rock will I found my church. So obviously you should found a church based on something to do with rocks and petroleum. As for the oleum part of petroleum, what is more holy in the Bible than oil, which is often used to anoint the anointed? So it's self-evident to me that this is an object of worship. But as Scripture also says, where your treasure is, there is your heart also. And a lot of people de facto worship oil now anyway, so why not give it a church?
This is one of those moments, and they happen frequently throughout the book, when I get the sense that you were smiling as you created things. There's not just the Church of Petroleum, but also some fascinating creatures. The mohair sheep, for instance.
Well,
everybody wished they could have one.
I think so. Yes, and I'm waiting for somebody to bring this online, because we have the tools to do it. When I first wrote Oryx and Craig, I had them raising human kidneys and pigs in the pigoons, and also human cortex tissue, all of it intended for transplant into humans. But the same techniques would allow you to grow human hair on sheep and keyed to your own DNA, so that it would transplant very easily onto your head. And who wouldn't want that?
And the racunks. Of course, as you hear that, you can hear the ass and the kunk in there, and you wonder.
Yes, they are a blend of raccoon and skunk, and they were developed as a new and improved pet animal. Skunks have lovely dispositions. Raccoons maybe not so much, but they're very curious and lively. So you'd get a curious, lively, but benign animal, devoid of the ability to spray, and very, very cute.
Did you have fun?
Did I have fun?
You're laughing even as you begin to think about the answer.
Did I have fun? Do chickens have beaks? Well, as it turns out, not always. Because there's also in this world the chicky knobs, which are chickens without heads. The nutrients are dumped in the top, and they grow multiple wings, thighs, and breasts.
Oh, dear, that's not so funny, is it?
I don't know. I'd got that idea from an urban legend, and the urban legend was that Colonel Sanders was using chickens that had four drumsticks. I don't believe it's true, but various other things are done to chickens. Whereas with chicky knobs, no brain, no pain, they would not suffer. And think how productive they would be.
One of the things that's clear from this is that you've looked into it. You're interested in technology. These things are possible. It isn't really the tools that are inherently good or bad, is it? It's how we use them.
Human beings don't invent things as a rule that are not done to fulfill their wishes or combat their fears. So we always have the best intentions, but things can go off the rails. And with human tools in general, there's a good use, a bad use, and a stupid use that we didn't think of at the time. So it isn't, in fact, the tools that are in themselves good or bad. It's what we do with them.
It's your point of view.
That's my point of view.
There's a section in the book, and you describe Zeb's life as a hacker. And I have to confess that when I was reading that, it made me think about some of the cyberpunk novels, William Gibson, that kind of thing. Were you influenced at all by that in writing this?
I think we all have been, if not by the literature about it, by our experience of it in our daily life. Every time you get an alert that a new virus has been unleashed, that if you answer the... If you open the I love you attachment, immediately your computer is going to crash. Or that somebody may have hacked your computer unbeknownst to you and be using it as a robot computer to send millions of messages to other people. We're all influenced by this. And there is a huge amount of cybercrime going on. And if you would like to read about that, there are two books that I can mention. And one is called McMafia, and it's by Misha Glenny. And the other is called Black Code, and it's by Ron Debert. And both of them really live in and explore this world and can tell you about the kinds of things that are going on right now, invisible to you.
But that inspire your imagination when you start to think about what could be happening and what may happen from that as a result?
Yeah, the hacking that goes on in my book is pretty standard. One of the things that Zeb does is he hacks into some bank accounts and just removes small amounts of them, and that's happening quite a lot right now. The real criminals don't want to make a big splash. They want to do their hacking and extracting without anybody knowing about it. So he does that. And there are other kinds of hacking in that are used to, you know, crash people's systems or put up another message, and that's the kind of thing that Anonymous has sometimes done.
All those little things we do.
All those little or quite big things we do, because Ron Debert's outfit, which is called the Citizen Lab, it was they who discovered that somebody had hacked the Indian military and therefore knew not only what it was doing, but what anybody doing business with it was doing. And he also discovered that somebody in China had made it so that they could look at you through the camera on your computer. And there is a lot of this going on, and my advice to you is if you don't want anybody looking at you through the camera in your computer, duct tape is your friend.
It sounds like good advice. It's interesting
we're so well-meaning and innocent that we think, well, who would ever do that to me? But actually a lot of people would.
There's a kind of a dichotomy here. Well, there's several things going on, and that's a good thing about the pleasure of reading Mad Adam. You're very interested in science. I gather that's in part because of family influence. Your father was an entomologist, is that right?
Yes, he was an entomologist. My brother is a biologist. And I could have turned into one of those too, but I took a different road.
Some of that must be apparent in the first book when you have the difference between Crake and Snowman.
Well, Crake is good at math and science, and Jimmy Snowman isn't. So Crake goes off to the Watson Crick Institution, and poor Jimmy has to go to the Martha Graham Academy where the food is substandard and they study the arts. But that's not me. That's happening now. If you look at the decline in liberal arts universities on this continent today, you will see that that is already in process. Oddly enough, a lot of the science and tech communities are now realizing that one of the fastest ways to transmit things is through storytelling. So they're now turning back to storytelling as a mode of teaching. Weird, isn't it?
It Well, it's probably a good thing, especially if you want people to better understand each other. You've described yourself as an Alice in Wonderland kind of writer. Verdict first, trial afterward. Is that right?
Yes, I think so. By which I mean that I do the writing first, and then I research it and fact check it to see if I got it right.
Do you discover that you didn't get it right often?
Sometimes I do, indeed. I can think of two instances. One was with Cat's Eye, where I thought I remembered the brownie song that you sang as you danced around the mushroom. This is something that boys didn't do, by the way, so you probably never did it. I hope you
did. I'm afraid not.
No, well, you came out and you were an elf, a fairy, or a pixie, or a gnome, and each one of them had its own song. And you danced around a paper mache mushroom. And I thought I had those words by memory, but when I went back and checked the brownie handbook, I found that I had made several mistakes. So I corrected them.
That seems like an easily misremembered thing. Does it affect your creative process? Does knowing too much get in the way?
That's why it's verdict first, trial afterwards, because I feel if I do too much research ahead of time, I'm going to get bogged down by it and stray off into side channels, as it were, get distracted.
Mad Adam is, of course, the conclusion of a trilogy. It started with Oryx and Craig. Each of them has been described as dystopian. I guess the whole is called a dystopian trilogy, but I'm told that that's not the word you would use. Is that fair?
Well, these words get batted around quite a bit. So people use the word apocalypse to mean something bad has happened. But usually it means everything has been destroyed, which is not the case in these books. It's only human beings who have suffered a sad fate. Animals, plants, and fish are actually doing better, as they probably would. So dystopia usually means a very unpleasant society that we would not wish to live in. And that could be used about the first phase of the time in the trilogy, in which corporate rule is supreme and government has been reduced to a sock puppet. And people don't have anything that you might call any recourse. They have no... They have nothing outside the system to which they can turn for redress against the excesses of the system, which is why you don't want a monopoly and why you don't want government and business melding. So that part could be called a dystopia. The actual waterless flood could be called a cataclysm. And the part afterwards, I'm not sure what you would call it, because it's better for some. Though obviously worse for all those who are no longer in a living condition.
I understand you use the word eustopia.
Well, that was when I was discussing the form. And what I said was that every utopia, every literary utopia, contains a little dystopia within it. And every literary dystopia contains a little utopia within it. So it's a yin-yang arrangement. They are as forms joined at the hip. They're twins. And you can't really write a utopia unless you understand that there's something worse. And you can't write a dystopia unless you understand that there's something better.
And that's, to some extent, where Mad Adam comes in. There is maybe something better in the middle
there's
of this.
Yeah, there's certainly something better, and there's certainly also something worse. So both things are present.
I was thinking back about the first dystopian novel, was the word used to describe it, that you wrote, The Handmaid's Tale. It was a long time again. Between that and the beginning of this trilogy, wasn't it? 20
yes,
years or so?
Yes, there was quite a long. Yes, there was quite a long time. And why was that? I don't know. I was writing other novels, quite a few other novels. In point of fact.
Well, and in fact, you've written some things in between each of the volumes of this trilogy, haven't you?
I know it's. I shouldn't do that. I should really just stick to one thing. But I am easily distracted.
What's been the reaction? I don't know what it is you're trying to get from Mad Adam. You're obviously trying to entertain, and you've succeeded admirably at that. Do you see this trilogy as a wake up call, a call to action?
Well, if it were just a call to action, I would have in it some action that we're supposed to do. And there are novels like that. Nicholas Nickleby was one of them. It was directed at corrupt boys' schools, and the thing we were supposed to do was obviously close down the corrupt boys' schools. I don't think there's anything quite so simple with this, because I think that the world we live in is now so complex that we don't know which end of the ball of string to get hold of. I think it's more like maybe we should think about this.
You sound to me like a fairly optimistic person. Would you think of yourself that way?
Well, I'm just a little bundle of sunshine in my daily life. Why not? Every writer is inherently optimistic, no matter how pessimistic the content they may produce, because writing is in itself an optimistic act. Just think about it. You're assuming a future reader, which is a big leap. Every time you write something down, you're assuming that somebody's going to read it at the other end. So you're also assuming the possibility of human communication. And you're assuming that that's a good thing. So when you're writing a book, you're assuming that you're going to finish it, not always justified by the facts. You're assuming that somebody's then going to publish it, also not so easy. Then you're assuming that people will read it. Wow, what a jump. And then that they will like and understand it, which is a pretty big bunch of optimism. And that is why Jimmy and Oryx and Craig does not keep a Robinson Crusoe-like journal of his experiences, because he cannot imagine a future reader. He thinks he's the last person on earth who can read. Whereas Toby does, because she can imagine future readers, and she even goes so far as to go about creating them.
You've written a number of different kinds of novels now. You've talked about the positive future in this, the possibility of a future. Are you done with utopian writing for a while?
I just met a physicist the other day who told me that his latest discovery is that time is real. Aren't you relieved to hear that? And the consequence of that is that the future is open, that it is not all set in stone. It hasn't all happened before somewhere. We aren't just repeating something that is fated. So that means that I don't know, because the future is open and I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. So I try to avoid making pronouncements about what I may or may not do in the future.
But you are certainly going to write more, if you don't get hit by the bus.
Not if I get hit by a bus.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you.